This is Wade Rathke, and you're listening to Wade's World, a Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points north and south, east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at www.kbf.org and www.acornradio.org. A podcast will be available, the show, on these websites and www.affiliatedmediamovement.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Serhii Ploihe, who's a professor at Harvard University, and he's written the book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Disaster. Welcome to Wade's World, Professor Ploihe.
Well, hello, Wade. It's a pleasure.
Well, first, we're going to have to remind people about this disaster. I mean, if you're a certain age, you say the word Chernobyl, and immediately, a cold sweat breaks out. But not everybody may know about this. So remind people why this was such world-shaking news.
If you go online and check Wikipedia and look for nuclear disasters, Chernobyl will be at the very top. So there are three major nuclear disasters that happened in the world. So Chernobyl, the explosion that took place on April 26th, the night of April 26, 1986, is ranked number one. Number two is Fukushima, and the Three Mile Island accident here in the United States in the late 1970s is number three. And the way how they're ranked on the basis of the amount of radiation that was released as the result of a given accident. In Chernobyl case, it's 50 million curie of radiation, and just to explain what that means, to put that into perspective, this is roughly equivalent of 500 Hiroshima-type bombs. So that's what Chernobyl was, and it is and will continue to be for a while one of the radioactive elements that was released as the result of the explosion. It's called plutonium-239, the stuff that is used in atomic bombs. The half-life of it is 24,000 years. Half-life means that in 24,000 years, half of that radiation power that element has will disappear, and then in another 24,000 years, the rest will be gone. Again, plutonium-239, it's a minor, not a lot of that was released. Most of the stuff that was released already either is gone or maybe already past its half-life. But again, some elements of released by Chernobyl will be with us with our grandchildren for quite
a while. Yeah, way past what any of us
right.
know. We'll just have to hope for the best there. Now, many of us, and certainly I've seen these pictures in National Geographic and elsewhere. I mean, the zone around Chernobyl is still a stark, ghost-like experience. I mean, the pictures you see, it's still sort of, maybe this is overwrought, but death and destruction all around the plant site. Is that still the case? Or?
Clearly there is a lot of things that are basically were destroyed, but destroyed not by the explosion per se, but by the this effort after the accident to somehow deal with the radiation. The interesting thing is, and again I compared that to Hiroshima bombs, but Chernobyl was different in a sense that as a result of the explosion only two people died on the spot. But then later, 31 people died from the acute radiation syndrome, from the overexposure to radiation in the next few weeks. And then the big question is about thousands and tens of thousands of people whose health was affected. But radiation is basically an invisible thing. So a few years ago, I went to the exclusion zone. It's a 30-kilometer exclusion zone. Within it is a 10-kilometer exclusion zone, which is basically immediately around the reactor. And it's a weird experience. It's like you go to the nuclear era Pompeii, with the exception that you don't have to engage in archaeological digs to find out what happened there, because the buildings are still there, but people are gone.
Because the area, you mean that's an area where no one is allowed to live at this point still?
Yes and no. People are not allowed to live there, but people are allowed to work there. And the reason for that is that they are completing now, it's a multi-billion project, they're completing construction of a new shelter, a new confinement above the damaged reactor, because again, it's still open, it's still there. Only 5% of the radiation of the fuel escaped and created a phenomenon equivalent to 500 Hiroshima-type bombs. So 95% of that extremely poisonous stuff is still there, and that's why they're building new confinement. So people are there working around the clock. And the zone itself, it's a very interesting thing that some of the areas within the zone are just super contaminated. It's bad for your health to be there. The estimates are that the zone will not be safe or fully safe at least for another 200-300 years. But there are spots which are perfectly okay. It all depended on the direction of the wind at a given moment, whether it was rain or not rain, so there were a lot of components. So in this relatively clean parts of the zone, now they are building, or at least the plans are to build another power plant which will be solar. So it's an exclusion zone. It's dangerous, but also there are areas where people not live on the permanent basis, but they work.
In a tomb for what's left of the material.
Exactly. And again, they built the first one immediately after the explosion, mm-hmm. In summer and fall of 1986, but now that stuff is falling apart. And that the first one was made out of concrete. This one they're making out of steel, and they have been postponing the completion of the project now from 1 year to another, again and again and again, postponed this year. The reason for that is still high levels of radiation. So whatever plans they have to adjust them, and adjust their timetable.
We're talking to Professor Ploey of Harvard University, who's written a book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Disaster. Now, you were in the Ukraine when this happened. You had some personal interest in this, from what I read in your book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Again, I was a young university professor at that time. I had a family, two young children. They spent the summer of 1986 indoors almost the entire summer. We were really very concerned about possible impact of Chernobyl, the possibility that the water would be contaminated. We were approximately 350 miles down the river Dnieper from Chernobyl, and at some point, a really kind of a mild panic wasn't in the city where it was announced, not officially, but there was rumor that the water, contaminated water from Chernobyl, is approaching the city.
Wow.
And altogether, close to 30 million people depend on that, on water coming from Dnieper. So thank God the level of contamination was not as bad as feared. Most of the radioactive particles actually ended up on the bottom of the river, closer to the Chernobyl, never reaching our area. But that was one of concerns, 30 million people, and what do you do with that? The
And of course,
CTE, yeah.
What we know now about where that radiation ended up on the bottom of the river is certainly not something you knew contemporaneously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
You can imagine, I don't know what 30 million people would do, but now you had the opportunity recently to sort of join a group of tourists going through part mm-hmm. of this area. What in the world? You talk about disaster tourism, Naomi Klein style, but this is a tourism at a disaster. How did
they start? Yeah. They opened those stores maybe 3-4 years ago, so I wasn't the first one who was on the tour. And they do that in Ukrainian and Russian. They do that also in English. I was part of the English group. And again, they gave us counters, and they assured us that it was safe, that we were not getting on that trip for the entire day more radiation than we get when we take a transatlantic flight. So we believed our tour guide. But again, it's a very, very, on the one hand, interesting, on the other hand, very scare experience, because you see what the nuclear power can do. And on the one hand, as long as things are good and fine, this is one of the safest ways and the cleanest sources of energy. But if things go bad, they go really bad.
I think I read, and you probably would know this better, that an environmental group, I think it was perhaps Greenpeace, said recently that there were signs of contamination in milk up to 140 miles from the Chernobyl site. Did you see that recently?
Well, 140 miles away from Chernobyl, that's really nothing. So the Soviet government was trying actually to hide the information about what happened. But 2 days later, they discovered high levels of radiation in Sweden. So at the nuclear power plant there. So the Swedes were the first who sounded the alarm, and then again it went all the way to Poland and to Germany and to all the way to Britain as well. Again, the levels of radiation rose number of times higher than norm, but still they were considered to be not particularly dangerous to human beings, with the exception that, of course, the milk coming from the cows, because that the radiation, if there is a rain, it goes into grass, and then cows eat that grass and produce milk. So some of the most affected areas in Europe are, for example, in Alps, parts of Austria were affected. I have a map of the impact, this radiation impact on Europe in my book.
Exactly.
But there are quite a few of those maps online. And again, you would be surprised that some of the areas as far away as northern Italy can be affected as badly as maybe neighboring parts of Russia or Ukraine. The country that suffered the most is Belarus. There was Belarus. Up to 30% of its territory. It's not terribly big country. Close to 30% of its territory was affected.
And are those impacts still lingering?
Oh yeah, they're still there, and different governments deal with that differently. For example, in Ukraine, as the result of the mass mobilization 2 or 3 years after the explosion, all of this information is in the open. There are all sorts of laws that try to help protect the people who were affected by the explosion, or somehow support them financially, socially, and otherwise. In Belarus, the government is taking a very different position. With one third of your territory being affected, their line is that okay, it's not nothing too terrible happened, that it's okay and we can keep going. In France, for example, there was no information whatsoever, and until now, the idea is that Chernobyl somehow didn't affect them much, despite the fact that in Germany and in Britain, there was serious concern. Why did the in France they were not concerned? Well, today 75% of French
power
is nuclear.
Right.
So they just discovered that when Chernobyl happened, the G7 statement that was made at that time, and the meeting of G7 was taking place in Japan, was playing with the language so not to scare the Japanese public of nuclear energy, because again Japan was so much dependent on nuclear. So the governments play politics with the real or possible effects of disasters like Chernobyl.
Well, your book argues that they had some warning signs that this could be a problem at Chernobyl way before this accident.
Yes, absolutely. And again, the one of the issues was the design problems, the problems with the design of the reactor. And for the first time, they got a clear idea that it can be bad was in 1975 at the nuclear power plant next to the city that is today called St. Petersburg. At that time, the name was Leningrad. And there was a partial meltdown, but again, not of the proportions of Chernobyl. But really, lessons were not learned, and there are numerous reasons for that. But one of them is that, well, the reactors that exploded in Chernobyl were really very cheap to produce. They were twice as powerful as the reactors, other type of reactors that they also built in the Soviet Union, but they were more expensive and less powerful. And then to save money, they never bothered to build the confinements above the reactor, something that is a standard here in this country and in Western Europe as well. So that was the disaster that was there waiting to happen, and then indeed it happened.
And have lessons been learned from that? Surely that kind of design feature has been corrected. And
yes, but by now, basically, we don't have those reactors. They're decommissioned, so Chernobyl is closed. There are a new generation of reactors, so those lessons were learned. But there is a set of other issues that led to Chernobyl that are still here with us, and one of them is, of course, that when the industry looks for the ways how to save money, that is very much the story of Chernobyl, and this is still with us today. Another issue with Chernobyl is that that was the problem that was partially brought by what I would call the first generation of nuclear engineers and scientists. Quite a few of people who worked at that plant, because there was such huge extension expansion of nuclear industry. They didn't have enough people trained in nuclear engineering. So the director, the chief engineer of the plant were not nuclear engineers. And one of things that brings is that the safety culture when it comes to nuclear industry was simply not there. And this is the story now in the countries that are acquiring nuclear energy, especially in the Middle East. So today, United Arab Emirates are building four nuclear reactors. Two nuclear reactors are being under construction in Egypt. They just declared a program of building 40 new nuclear reactors in the Middle East in the next 20 years, which raises all sorts of concerns in terms of the some of those areas are areas where earthquakes are taking place. We hear a lot about nuclear program in Iran. What we don't hear is that the nuclear reactor that exists now there is basically built in the area where every 8 years at least an earthquake takes place. Again, they try to take this into account and so on and so forth. But we know what happened in Japan with Fukushima. So in that sense, the lack of safety culture is something that was there at the time of Chernobyl and is today, especially in these countries of Northern Africa and Middle East, the new frontier of nuclear industry.
Well, and we're talking to Professor Sari Ploie, who's a professor at Harvard University and head of the Ukraine Research Institute there, about his new book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe. And so when you raise that specter, I mean, what we have to always look at in these disasters is the lessons, and that's the point you're making here. Should there be, should nuclear power plants only be allowed to be built in areas that are depopulated? In Fukushima, obviously, the closeness to the water, made them, I mean, that's one of the lessons that Japan is taking, but of course it's an island nation state, so you're never going to be that far from many places in the water, but people are throwing these power plants, the nuclear plants have often been constructed very close to cities, even if you look at the pattern of what's been constructed in the U.S. Is that a lesson that we should take away?
Absolutely. Before Chernobyl happened, one of the principal designers of the reactor published a major article suggesting that the nuclear power plants in the Soviet Union were built too close to the cities. So it was approximately 100 miles away from the city of Kyiv, with the population over 2 million. And he suggested building them in Siberia. The problem was that, of course, there were already a lot of reactors being built in the European part of the Soviet Union, which was most, in terms of the population, was the most of the Soviet population lived there. But another thing was that they never solved the issue of how to bring that electric power to the consumers if the nuclear plants are built at a significant distance.
Right, because so, you lose some in transmission.
You lose exactly. And at that point, they believed that it has to be the maximum from the consumers. It can be something like 400 miles. Again, I don't know exactly now, but I don't think that they solved that problem. Again, what we see today, in particularly in what used to be First World, the United States, Western Europe, Japan, with the exception of France, most of the countries either just try to go nuclear free, or there is the nuclear industry is not really developing in any way in terms of its expansion. One of the reasons for that, again, Germany is going nuclear-free. Japan is trying to do the same. Here today, it's actually cheaper to buy a new unit of electricity produced by renewables than by nuclear.
Mm-hmm.
Again, part of the reason is that in different ways the government subsidizes today the renewables. But that was also the case with the early nuclear industry. So it was getting a lot of government support in the first decades of its development. So in a sense, nuclear is now in a situation where people don't like it because of Chernobyl and Fukushima and are afraid of it. But also economically, it becomes actually it's quite expensive. And the question is major companies are actually filing for bankruptcy in the last 2 years. Westinghouse is one out of them. What was bought by a Japanese firm.
Well, Entergy is a big company that's headquartered out of New Orleans, and part of their business is managing nuclear power plants all around the U.S. and elsewhere, and they're troubled. One of the points you make, Professor, that I don't want to lose here is this problem of doing the work cheap and how it's the oversight from governments. When you talk about building the massive numbers you just mentioned to us in the Middle East and Africa, you have to wonder whether or not there's the how we'll protect against those problems in those communities, so whether or not they have the infrastructure to draw the line and say, you know, pay for the best equipment, or are you taking a shortcut here? And that's scary to me.
Yeah, the situation improved since 1986. For example, the Soviet Union was, back then it was Cold War, there was no international oversight, no international cooperation. Chernobyl changed that. So now there is a much more in interconnection. But that being said, most of the regimes in the Middle East, and again, as I said, this is the new frontier of nuclear industry. It's not very popular in Europe or in the U.S., but it becomes popular there for different reasons. You wouldn't imagine that Middle East needs nuclear when they have oil, but nuclear industry is also a backdoor to acquiring nuclear weapons. So that's another issue. Now, none of those states is really well known for democratic values. It's basically authoritarian regimes.
I mean, look at Egypt these days as an example, or anywhere in the Middle East, right?
Sure. And again, what that means if the authoritarian regimes, they have a tendency of exercising a lot of power over information. And again, we don't know what will happen with Iran, with this deal now being void. If there is no inspection, okay, here you have a country that is desperate to produce not just nuclear energy, but is interested in nuclear weapons. So again, the political situation there, and some of those regimes are not really very stable. Recently, we had a discussion in media about the some terrorist group allegedly firing some kind of a rockets in the direction of the nuclear power plants in United Arab Emirates under construction. Whether that happened or not, but again, that's a possibility.
Well, this is sobering now. You know, this is not, we're not talking about the good news bears here on Wage World today. But, Professor, I guess one of the points that you and I have made clearly is your book is not just something about something that happened some decades ago. This is still a front page issue that all of us should be concerned about. How do people get a hold of your book, Chernobyl, The History of a Nuclear Catastrophe?
Well, I guess the one possibility is just to support your local bookseller, and again, the book is available. Other than that, it's on Amazon, and you can certainly save a couple of bucks by going on Amazon.com. So it is available, and again, in case you have any questions, I will be more than happy to answer it. Please email me. It's plokhii@FAS, which means Faculty of Arts and Sciences, .harvard.edu, and my email is on the website of the Department of History at Harvard as well.
We, you know, say that email one more time before we leave, just so that people know how to do it.
Sure, absolutely. So it's P as in Peter, LOKHII at F as in Frank, A as in Anthony, S as in Sam, .harvard.edu.
Harvard's a little school up in Massachusetts along the river, so, you know.
Right, and it's pronounced very often without that R in the middle, but please don't forget to put it in when you email me.
Good point. Thank you so much, Professor. It's been great to have you. This has been Wage World for another week, the world where the other half lives. Yes, sir, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. As the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week when we have another guest, this is Wade Rathke from Wade's World. Thank you.
This program is produced by the Arkansas Broadcasting Foundation, KABF-FM in Little Rock, Arkansas, and is distributed through Affiliated Media Foundation Movement, AMFM, serving the needs and interests of low and moderate income Americans.